This is a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast.
You listen to the bite-sized business breakfast, the best bits from the show on Wednesday, September the 15th, where we spoke to Rustin Edwards. Now, Rustin is from Euronav. Euronav do tankers. Tankers load up with crude oil and other fuels and transport them around the world. Tankers having a pretty tough time of it at the moment because of OPEC and other restrictions. However, their near neighbours, containers, they're the big ones with those boxes on them, are doing really, really well. In fact, prices are going through the roof and prompting many observers to talk about a shipping industry boom at the moment. However, important to differentiate between tankers and containers, as we found out from Rustin, who gave us a very, very insightful look at the shipping industry and who's doing well and who's not at present. We also spoke to Zahn Shahinke from Property Monitor. Their latest report actually came out earlier today. It arrived in Brandy's inbox before it arrived anywhere else, and Zahn was more than happy to work through the latest numbers, which will speak a positive picture, or certainly paint a positive picture when it comes to money per square footage. We're seeing yet another increase, and of course demand out there in the real estate market. Today was the day that we got first look, or certainly last night was the first opportunity for us to look at what was new from all things Apple as they launched their new versions of phones, watches, iPads, iPad minis, and much, much more. We had Ashish Panjabi of Jackie's Electronics to come on and tell us a little bit more about what we learnt last night from the Apple launch. Plus, Sarinda Kelly was in the house to talk about all the latest news headlines and some of the big stories in the fight against COVID-19.
Ask Serena.
Well, Serena Kelly had not one but two press conferences to keep her busy last night.
Actually, it was three.
Three? Yeah. What was the third?
WHO.
So we had the WHO, had the British.
Yep, and the one here in the UAE.
And the local one as well.
Yeah.
Embarrassment of riches, Serena Kelly.
Where would you like to begin?
Popcorn out. Let's start with the WHO, only because I know you're a little bit of a fan of a Dr. Tedros. We all need a COVID crash to get us through.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, and a lot was actually shared from their press briefing yesterday. So it was WHO Director General Dr. Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus issued an urgent call for vaccine equity globally, especially in Africa.
So far, just two countries in Africa have reached the 40% target, the lowest of any region. That's not because African countries don't have the capacity or experience to roll out vaccines. It's because they have been left behind by the rest of the world. More than 5.7 billion doses have been administered globally, but only 2% of those have been administered in Africa.
It was stressed that this, the worst pandemic in the last 100 years, will not end unless and until there is genuine global cooperation on vaccine supply and access.
This does not only hurt the people of Africa, it hurts all of us. The longer vaccine inequity persists, the more the virus will keep circulating and changing, the longer the social and economic disruption will continue, and the higher the chances that more variants will emerge that render vaccines less effective.
The WHO, as we all are aware, established the COVAX initiative, trying to get COVID-19 vaccines to countries in need. So far, they've shipped more than 260 million doses to 141 countries. Dr. Tedros had a message for vaccine distributors and manufacturers, but also for countries recognizing vaccines.
We call on all countries and manufacturers to share information on bilateral deals with COVAX and Abbott, so we understand where vaccines are needed most, and we call on all countries to recognize all vaccines with WHO emergency use listing. I may sound like a broken record. I don't care. I will continue to call for vaccine equity until we get it.
Just a reminder, the ones that are approved by the WHO, you've got Pfizer, BioNTech, AstraZeneca, Johnson & Johnson, Moderna, Sinopharm and Sinovac. The WHO's global vaccination target is for 70% of the world's population of all countries to be vaccinated by mid 2022. They did share some positive figures. Nearly 4 million new cases were reported globally in the past week. That's from the 6th to the 12th of September. This is the first substantial decline in weekly cases in more than 2 months. The number of fatalities reported globally in the past week also have decreased as compared to the previous week, with just over 62,000 new deaths. And the cumulative number of cases reported globally is now 226 million, up more than 226 million. And the cumulative number of fatalities is just over 4.6 million.
So that's the WHO presser. Yep. In a nutshell, without Nicki Minaj, do you want to tell us what came out of the UK?
Yeah, basically what they're saying is it was throwing forward to prepare as winter is around the corner. It was England's chief medical officer saying going into winter with a high number of COVID cases means it won't take much to get into trouble. They revealed several contingency plans yesterday. Plan A and Plan B includes a possible return to mandatory face coverings and working from home, basically just trying to take the pressure off of the NHS, their healthcare system there. And also, even though the vaccine passports were shelved, plans for them were shelved recently, the Prime Minister did go on to say that, it, you know, depending on the situation and how it develops, it could be that they may be put back on the table further as we get closer towards the end of the year.
And locally?
Locally, last night's government press briefing, it was Nasser Al-Zabi, the official spokesperson for the Ministry of Community Development, was speaking. He shared results of a survey on the UAE's recovery from the pandemic. So basically, one was done last year in April, and they've recently done another one, and they were comparing results and figures, so to speak. So here's what they found. 95% of people expressed a higher sense of trust and safety during the COVID-19 pandemic compared to 25% in April of last year. 94% of residents are optimistic about going back to normal life, so to speak, compared to 34% of April last year. 79% supported a 100% return to the workplace. 90% supported the gradual resumption of religious practices in mosques and other places of worship. And 73% supported students' return to schools. But if you're looking for more details, it's all up on the ARN News Centre.
It's quite shocking that we are now able to do a survey and compare it to last year's pandemic survey.
Yeah.
We don't want a third, do we?
Nope. Well, it would only just be up, hopefully, if you did one next year compared to this year.
Hopefully next year will be our post-pandemic survey.
Yes.
Anything else we need to know, Serena Kelly, before we let you go? There's new rules in the sporting arena?
In the sense that the Mubadala World Tennis Championship is returning to Abu Dhabi from December 16th, Zayed Sports City. It's the 13th edition of the competition. Spectators will be welcome with a reduced capacity in line with the government's regulations. So obviously more details will be forthcoming closer to the time. And the Emirates Dubai Rugby Sevens just got their approvals from the Crisis Committee and government stakeholders. We knew it was coming back, but now they've got the approvals with regards to how it's going to be run. They are hosting the event in December, opening the gates to all spectators. Tickets set to go on sale from September 23rd. But we'll be waiting to hear what those guidelines will be with regards to safety measures and precautions.
Serena Kelly, thank you very much.
More details on the ARN News Centre app.
Catch up on the business headlines with the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast.
This morning, we are looking at a certain iPhone launch.
You used to call me on my cell phone. Late night when you need my love. Call me on my cell phone.
Well, Drake's got a new cell phone to choose from. For technically, Apple has launched the iPhone 13 Pros, Minis, the whole lot. But will the changes be enough to convince us to upgrade? Very pleased to be speaking again to Ashish Panjabi, Chief Operating Officer at Jackie's Electronics. Ashish, good morning.
Morning, Brandy.
Right, so the Apple launch, we get excited when the invitation comes out. In your considered opinion, and if we just look at the iPhone to start with, is it worth the hype?
So it's a question of, do you need to upgrade? I think the iPhone 13 and the iPhone 13 mini were sort of incremental upgrades. There wasn't really anything dramatic. It's more or less the same design. And it's a question that if you really need a phone that, because yours is not working, it's the one to go for at the moment. If you're looking at that, the pros are a little different because if you are one of those people who loves camera, who loves the new video effects, you're a professional, yeah, there is a reason for an upgrade over there. Otherwise, it's more or less a little bit more polish, a few new colors, and some incremental upgrades.
Does anyone actually care anymore about anything other than the camera and maybe the battery life?
Well, I think they've gotten to a point where they've gotten fairly good. And I think where the whole mobile phone industry is sort of heading right now is they're sort of looking for a change in form factor. And we've sort of seen that with Samsung in the last couple of years, and especially this year with the Z Fold 3 and the Flip 3. I mean, you are starting to see the new form factors come into place, and that is sort of where there is a little more excitement and, yeah, a reason to sort of think, let me change and let me do something new. Otherwise, no one's going to know you've got the new one because it looks just like last year's one in many ways.
What are we seeing happen to phone replacement cycles here in the UAE? How long do we keep hold of them for?
So it was interesting. It had started getting longer. And then we saw the iPhone 12 come last year. And I think a lot of that sort of, and maybe because we weren't going out as much, we weren't doing as much, the reason to upgrade sort of kicked in for a lot of people. So we did see the iPhone 12 do extremely well. And I think some of the colors as well. So when they, midway through the year, introduced the purple iPhone 12, that sold extremely well as well. So I think it's a question of you need to do something, you need to give a gift. We're getting into the gifting season. These are the type of products that sell.
I unfortunately don't know people who gift iPhones, but I'm open to suggestions. Right, let's talk storage. The iPhone 13 Pro comes with 1 terabyte of storage. Again, is this really a selling point, given the fact that the majority of us keep everything on the cloud?
So I think when you start talking about video, and when you look at how much video we're consuming and recording at the moment, the storage does build up very quickly. You need to just go on holiday, as many people have done this summer, to realize you've run out of storage on the phone. And the cloud is nice, but I think having that localized storage still is important for a lot of people, especially with the video and the other multimedia content that you have.
Okay, let's move away from the iPhone because it wasn't the only fruit at the Apple launch. Ho, ho. We also saw the Apple Watch 7 with probably more design upgrades than the phone.
Yeah. I mean, Apple has been quite clear, and I think it took them a couple of years to figure out what they wanted to do with the watch. And I think they've gone down the alleyway of saying, this is the ultimate fitness companion. And with Apple Fitness Plus, which is now being launched in the UAE as well as a service, you're starting to see a lot more in terms of functionality, in terms of features that the Apple TV, that the Apple Watch has got now. And it's got the ability to track you for any sort of exercise, whether you're doing Pilates, whether you're on your bike, whether you're in the pool. There is a lot more that the watch does for you.
Right. The other thing, of course, was the iPad. Now, we weren't expecting an iPad announcement, were we? But we got one.
Yeah. This came out of left field because we sort of expected an iPad launch to happen sort of with the MacBook launch later this year. The regular iPad, again, a small upgrade, but the iPad mini was sort of the start of the show for me. I mean, that was one of the products that lost a lot of love within Apple. And I think they've started to give it back the love it deserves. It's a great form factor, great size. It's got all the latest features. It's got the 5G capability. It's got the latest Apple Pencil support. And it looks like a very good device. It is something I'd like to have in my hand.
Right. So the $799 question, is it going to get us upgrading if we don't have to, or is it a needs-must upgrade?
Well, for the Mini, I think it's one of those products that I think can be used a lot. I use tablets all the time now. Most of my note-taking, most of my work happens on there. And I think with a lot of kids and with a lot of people at work now using a lot more of these digital tools, I think the need for it gets a lot more justified. And you aren't only using it for work, you're using it for sports, you're using it for entertainment, you're using it all over the place at the moment for fitness. So I can see the market for this growing.
Ashish Panjabi, Chief Operating Officer at Jackie's Electronics, speaking to us about that iPhone launch. And a bit of a reminder, it wasn't the only reason that Apple's been making news headlines in the last 24 hours. Security's been the other big one. And if you are an iPhone user, this is your public service announcement. If you do nothing else this morning, go and upgrade security. They have released a new patch. It's making headlines around the world. I did it while I was reading the news this morning. It was that quick and that simple. By the time we'd finished the headlines, my phone was upgraded. You know what to do. Go into general, go into security upgrades. Didn't even need to plug up my phone to do it, which normally you do. There you are.
It's not cheap, is it, this new iPhone 13? I'm just looking at the prices and the price range. So
3,000 dirhams, $799.
It's basic, though, isn't it? You can get that $3,399. Sorry, the 3,399 dirhams is for the basic iPhone 13. The mini is $3,000. 3,000 dirhams. If you want to go large, if you want to upgrade a little bit, the 13 Pro is 4,199. However, if you want to be really swish and really turn heads, and you go for the iPhone 13 Pro Max, that's just shy of $5,000. It's 4,699 dirhams. It's not cheap.
It's not. And the question is, why and when do you buy one? I bought one in Florida because I had to, and I knew there was a new phone coming. And so it kind of was a bit – I did it through gritted teeth because I thought there's a new phone coming, which means that the cost of the 12 will fall automatically when the 13 is announced. But you realize very quickly when you don't have a phone that everything you need to do to call an Uber, pull up your plane ticket, get the code for the luggage that you've – left somewhere in downtown Florida so you could go shopping unencumbered, etc., is all on your phone and you need it back. And so I replaced it within an hour of it drawing its last breath. But I did it because I had to, not because I thought, yeah, we'll go out and spend 3,000 dirhams this afternoon. Why not?
It's pricey.
This is the Bite Size Business Breakfast, exclusively on DubaiEye1038.com.
And I was delighted to have a property report bounce into my WhatsApp this morning just after 6 a.m. I have a special love for people who like to send me things ahead of their release. And this morning, my gratitude goes to Zan Johinki, Chief Operating Officer at Property Monitor. He was awake, he was alert, and he's earned himself a slot in the business breakfast as a result. Zan, it's lovely to speak to you. Good morning.
Likewise, Brandy. Thanks for having me on. Glad I hit your messages nice and early.
Yeah, love a bit of early morning data, Zan. Nothing like it. Property Monitor, of course, has its dynamic pricing index. You put it out every month. Let's have a look at August, which was a very curious month indeed. Traditionally slow for the real estate market because people go on holiday. What did we see this month?
Not a slow August. So like you said, typically August is actually the slowest month of the year. If we look at our market cycle in Dubai, like any market around the world, you have seasonality. The Dubai market typically picks up starting from September, and then we have the main part of the market going all the way through December. Then it slows down. We have a little bit of an uptick in the early part of the year. Nice little bump around July because people are going on vacations and holidays. And then coming back, August is traditionally the slowest month. This year, it was the second strongest month. And it's also the strongest August we've had since back to 2009. So about 5,800 transactions for the month came through and a good mix between off-plan and completed properties in that, about 60-40 split.
And so are you judging the strength of that August on the number of transactions or the size of those transactions?
So volume of transactions as number of transactions is always interesting because regardless of the price point or price appreciation, it means there's activity in the market. And that's what we want. We don't want to see a market slow down when nothing's transacting. So regardless of price being high or low, we want to see strong transaction numbers. So it's a good indicator. Coupled with that is prices have appreciated again, like you mentioned, for the 10th month in a row. So since bottoming out in November last year, we've had 10 months of growth. Last month, 1.6%. And since that bottom of the market, about 18.5%. And then what we're going to see is within the market cycle itself, we're mirroring the last recovery phase. So when we came out of that last dip, prices appreciated at a similar percent over the initial first 10 months of that recovery.
You look like a man with an opinion, Zan. In fact, I know you are one. What's your theory as to why we have had that strong August?
Look, it's a mix. There's some off-plan developments. I mean, the off-plan segment, new releases from developers have been really slow since the pandemic. And even leading up to that, the government put measures in place to slow down that excessive supply that was in the market in some segments. Now we've seen developers over the last quarter or so get a little more bullish, more projects coming into the market. So within those numbers, there is a good chunk of off-plan and initial developer sales that have come in. You've got a couple of developers with new project launches coming up, one last week or this week with Nikhil again, and you'll see a few more. So expect some of that volume increases to continue, but not in these mass wave of launches that we had back 5-6 years ago.
The other thing that's unusual about this month's property index from you, up until now, the growth that we've been talking about has all been villas and townhouses. Apartments haven't really been involved in this boom, if we can call it that. That's starting to change, you say?
Yeah, that dynamic's changing for a multiple of reasons. Villa and townhouses, there was so much value going into the early days of the pandemic. It was just, it was the perfect time to buy. No one really knew it was, but it worked out to be. And then we've seen this massive appreciation over that last sort of year period or so. But primarily villas and townhouses. The sellers now have gotten a little more bullish and asking prices significantly higher than previous sales. And what we're seeing now is that buyers aren't chasing that market. They're slowing down and they're going, look, I can agree with a 30, 40, 50% increase because the market was so low, but they're not willing to go a million above the last sales price on something that's sort of a 4 million property last sold and now they want five for it. That's not happening. And we're talking the majority of the market, the mass market, not the 10 million plus price point where the activity is just, it's unpredictable and you can't really put anything around it. They'll pay whatever they want to pay.
Right. So apartments now in the game. You mentioned, though, the bottoming out of those prices that we saw late 2020, because we do have to look at this historically, don't we? It's all very well to say, you know, the 10th month of rises. But where are we historically with prices at the moment?
So we're kind of right in the middle, funnily enough. So it's about 22% from the previous peak of the market. So that previous peak being September 2014. And we're 22.5% from the previous low of August 2009. So we're smack bang in the middle of historic prices. So the historic low and the historic high. If prices keep the trajectory right now, we've got about another 12 to 18 months in this cycle, which is a pretty short cycle. So what I'm hoping to see is that price appreciation on an emirate level will start to slow down, or the dynamics of that increase will change. So it'll shift from villas and townhouses now, and now we'll see apartments, like I mentioned before, start to become more popular. There's still value. So we might see 1-1.5% increases keep going for another year or two, but more buoyed by the apartment segment. If we keep seeing in the villa townhouse segment, we're probably heading towards that territory where things tend to pop.
Zanja Henke, Chief Operating Officer at Property Monitor, thank you very much for your time this morning, and thank you for sharing that data with us ahead of its general release, the monthly dynamic property index that Property Monitor put together.
Just the highlights. This is the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast.
Article about Bloomberg yesterday, which got people talking, got us talking, got you talking as well. The headline said it all. The global shipping industry is getting its biggest payday since 2008. The combination of booming demand for goods and a global supply chain that's collapsing under the weight of COVID-19 drives freight prices even higher. It seems that the container ships is where the bonanza is happening at the moment. A bonanza is centered around container shipping, where rates are spiraling ever higher to new records. It's got everybody waxing lyrical about all things shipping at the moment. The shipping industry is posting its strongest daily earnings since 2008, according to Clarkson Research Services, part of the world's biggest ship broker out there. And equally, the Clark Sea Index, which tracks daily earnings across a diverse range of shipping sector, already posting its longest run of monthly gains on record. But a big but here. Before we get too carried away and just call it the shipping industry in general, we must remember that there are different elements to the shipping industry. And to dive into that a little deeper, we've got the head of fuel oil procurement for Euronav, Rustin Edwards, joining us live on the line. And happy to say live via Microsoft Teams. Rustin, good morning to you.
Good morning to you all.
you are representing the world's largest independent quoted crude tanker platform. Euronav, an independent tanker company engaged in ocean transportation and storage of crude oil. So obviously a difference there between bulk carrying and container carrying. Is this sort of boom? Can you explain the reason behind the container freight boom for our listeners and viewers?
Certainly. I mean, it is a case of supply chains being squeezed on both the loading port and on the discharge ports. When you had COVID breakout, you had a massive slowdown in international commerce. So you did not have the usual container traffic moving on the different routes around the world. And you got to remember, container ships are much like a bus line. They're on a fixed schedule, fixed routes with fixed timings in each port to get in and out as quickly as possible to get the goods to the end user as quickly as possible. When COVID broke out, you had a massive slowdown in the world economy. You had lock-ins impacting both the supply side and the demand side, yet you still had people at home calling up their Amazons, calling up their Walmart.com in the United States, ordering goods to be delivered to their homes. So you still had a pull on demand as people were trying to live their lives in the COVID environment. But the supply chains had a hard time keeping up with that demand. And then once people started getting out back into the open, back into a more sense of reality, the surge of demand picked up, which basically caused a backlog to build up in the delivery ports and in the load ports. And so you end up with this squeeze of product being presented at the load ports, say maybe in China, and then not enough ships to move all those boxes out at the same time. And then when they got to the discharge port, you had bottlenecks getting those products out of the port into the end users, into the end consumers' hands. So net, you end up with two squeezes on both sides of the supply chain, which if anybody's ever taken a tram or a bus or, you know, in the London Tube, as soon as you have one problem in one station, those platforms build up with a lot of people very quickly during rush hour.
So a lot of people out there will be looking at this and going, thinking shipping industry and as a whole, and that everyone is benefiting, especially those massive container ships that we see, etc. But equally, I'm looking at your background at the moment and tankers, and people will be assuming, okay, if container freight is booming, then surely tankers are booming as well. Is that the case?
It is a bit of a yin and a yang. So back when COVID initially broke out and you had the OPEC plus supply disagreement, tanker rates took off like a rocket because the amount of crude available to the market versus the demand was far greater. I mean, there was a buildup of about a couple hundred million tons of crude in a matter of weeks, which resulted in very large freight rates. I mean, tanker rates skyrocketed from on average about $25,000 a day up to $150,000 a day. And a lot of tankers went into the storage business where basically they were loading crude and sitting offshore waiting for slots to open up in receiving terminals, or they just stayed on the ship as part of a general contango play by oil traders in general. But in that same time frame, dry bulk and container bulk markets suffered because there was no demand for the finished goods. And so those rates collapsed. Now, fast forward in from 2020 to 2021, or Q4 of 2020, is when the flip happened. The OPEC supply cuts started to really bite into the market, so there was less cargoes of crude oil available. Therefore, tanker rates collapsed, and they have remained in a very low level for the last 8 months, and probably will continue all the way into Q4 until we see more barrels coming back from OPEC, because every 400,000 barrels a day puts another 10 VLCCs back to work of OPEC production. So that's kind of a metric to look at as the market keeps moving forward and more barrels are released. But with the supply squeeze on the container side and on the dry bulk side, those rates have taken off and they're continuing to be very strong today. The only other part of the shipping industry that's probably still suffering, that's going to probably even lag tankers, will be the cruise line industry, as it'll be hard to get people to get on cruises again due to chance of being locked into a ship for 2 weeks.
Russ, are shipping companies taking the proverbial a little bit? We're told that there's no actual shortage of ships. Do the rates need to be as high as they are at the moment?
Well, the rates, when you look at containers, it is a factor of the logistics flow. So when you have boxes that get stacked up in the load port, people start wanting to pay a premium to put their box in front of the queue. Mm. And so that's what accelerates the increase in rates. When you think of container rates last year were on average running around $3,000 to $4,000 to move a box from China to the UK, and now that rate is about $17,000. A lot of that is the person who wants expedited delivery of those goods to get those goods onto the ship as quickly as possible, so they will pay up to put in front of an empty box. And of course, the shipping companies are more than happy to take that extra revenue. One thing that is noted recently is CGM-CMA, one of the other larger container lines, and announced that they were no longer going to be increasing their rates. They're going to try to keep their rates steady because there is now a creation of a lot of government scrutiny on the fact that container rates are so high and have been so high for so long.
Would it benefit tankers to carry containers? Could we ever see that situation?
You know, funnily enough, back when containerization started, they first moved on old T2 tankers, which were the tankers that were built back in World War II. Malcolm McLean and Sealand Industries, that's how they got started. That's how the whole container business started. However, in today's design criteria of an oil tanker, it is nearly impossible to get a container on top of an oil tanker. Mm-hmm. It is plausible that it could be done, but the amount of retrofitting that has to be done to take into account the camber of the tanker deck and then also the width of an oil tanker. As you, most of your listeners can see, oil tankers moving around the Straits of Hormuz and off Fujairah, oil tankers are wide. And they may not be able to fit to most container ports because container ships are designed for specific size criteria. So it's not feasible that could happen. Now, from the dry bulk sector, that's something that has been approved, and they are more readily available to take on containers because the nature of the interior structures of a dry bulk ship allow for the stacking of boxes in a Cohere's factor, so they can actually load enough boxes to move them around. And I think Golden Ocean was one of the first companies to announce that they've got class approval to do so.
Russ, unfortunately, we've got to leave it there. We're out of time. We could talk for a lot longer on this one, and maybe we will in the coming days. We'll watch on with interest. Really appreciate your time this morning. That was Rustin Edwards. Rustin is the head of fuel oil procurement for Euronav, joining us live on the line, talking all things shipping.
You've been listening to a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. To enjoy lots more from Dubai Eye in the United Arab Emirates, just go to DubaiEye1038.com or find them wherever you normally get your podcasts.